to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com. Today on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, we're going to cover some new ground with Ellen about what's behind and perhaps what's ahead of the Panama Papers kerfuffle, as Ellen will help us peek behind the gauzy curtain of international money interests and the public stories that were told, which reveal only a glimpse of the story, and probably the story they want us to hear. Hi, and welcome. I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute and co-host with Ellen on this biweekly investigation of what's going on with our money and who's messing with it. Ellen's guest this week is returning to the program. It's Les Leopold, director of the Labor Institute and noted author of many books, including Runaway Inequality, which gets to the heart of the economic system dynamics that have put Americans on a downward path of diminishing common wealth. Les is a fervent supporter of public banking and is on a national campaign to train citizens to take effective action to rebalance our system. And speaking of effective action, we're excited to introduce to you our new national project called What Wall Street Costs America, the launching of a new national discussion and campaign that has you at the heart and as a participant of a project designed to report on the many costs that result from local government reliance on Wall Street dollars for funding of public needs. It's a citizen-enabled grassroots platform for action. I'll be talking with PBI's Matt Standard about what it includes and how you can get involved. You're going to like it. And Matt will return to the program after Ellen talks with Les to give us some brief consideration of what the presidential candidates are really saying in their touted proposals for Wall Street reform. But let's get started and talk with Ellen about her latest article focused on the events of this past week.
The title is The War on Savings, the Panama Papers, Bail-ins, and the Push to Go Cashless. So what's happening here with the Panama Papers? How does this take in so many different dimensions of intrigue?
Well, on the face of it, the reason people are outraged, of course, is that it shows that there's all this money hidden in offshore tax havens and that they aren't being taxed. And so the people with big money and the corporations with big money aren't paying their fair share of taxes. And that's where the outrage comes from. But Pepe Escobar called it a limited hangout because only out of 11.2 million documents, only a few are going to be revealed. So it's not a true WikiLeaks sort of thing where all the information is made public so that the alternative people can pore over it and make of it what they will. They're only releasing certain documents, which are all pretty much all targeted at America's economic competitors or enemies, notably Russia, Syria, Iran, and then you have your token Westerners. For example, the Prime Minister of Iceland, which is obviously a Western country, but Iceland is also the only country that didn't bail out their banks and instead threw their bankers in jail. So that's still somewhat an enemy of the big Wall Street and City of London interests. It may be. Well, I saw a good set of interviews with the suggestion that it was the CIA. It wasn't a leak. It was actually, they actually broke in, you know, how they managed to break into all these secret records and got the information. And the intent was to get our competitors. But what it did was it opened up a can of worms and so opened up outrage that it wasn't intended. So in other words, the limited use for which it was made available to the major media, who are of course all corporate controlled, has now gotten out of hand, and now everybody's looking at places that they weren't intended to be looking. So anyway, you have all this outrage now about offshore tax havens, but it does appear that the reason that it was exposed in the first place, and particularly the way it's timed to come out right now, was maybe for other purposes, namely to nail down where the money is somebody wants to know where all this money is in order, arguably, I'm arguing that it has to do with bail-ins. And we did see the first of the bail-ins April 10th. So just now we had the first of the European bail-ins under the new 2016 rules, which will also bail in the depositors. So it's basically a Cyprus-style bail-in that is now being imposed on all the member countries. And the first hit in Austria happened to not have any depositors because it was a good bank, bad bank situation, but it had bondholders who thought they had the guarantee of the government, and the government of that particular province, Corinthia, is bankrupt. So they said, sorry, they can't pay on the guarantee. So here you have some big banks, Deutsche Bank, UBS, and PIMCO, which is, you know, a big bondholder group, that are all taking big losses on bonds that they thought were as good as money. Bonds are always considered totally safe, sound investments, but they weren't. They're going to lose 50%. And there was an immediate casualty of another bank, you know, a German, small German bank that went under because these bonds were a portion of their capital holdings, but it was only 1.5% of their capital, and somehow that managed to take them down altogether. So the fear is that this is going to trigger, you know, a domino effect all across Europe, and we'll see the banks go down, and we'll see a massive bail-in of depositor funds. And for that, they want first all the money to be there in the banks so they can bail them in. They don't want the possibility of taking your money and running, so that's an argument for going all cashless. And they want to know where the bodies are buried. So there's this push to have all this money that's offshore, to have it all made public. So you can't really hide your money offshore anymore.
And you suggested that this is the way for the 1/10 1% to expose and extract then from their buddies just below them in the top 10%. People who are saved don't have to borrow, is it?
Yeah, Michael Hudson wrote in his latest book, Killing the Host, that the way the 1% make their money is by lending to the 99%. And so it's always loans at interest, and there's never enough money to pay back all these debts, partly because the lenders, the creditors, don't put the money back into the system in order to pay off the debts. I mean, they save it, they hoard it, they put it in offshore tax havens.
So we see the host being eaten.
So they've eaten, they've already eaten the 99%. So now who are they going to feed on? The 99% are all borrowed up. There's nowhere else to go. So now they're feeding on the rung just below them in the chain. Actually, Margaret Kennedy said 10% of the population. She's a German researcher who is now deceased, unfortunately. But in her researches of about 10 years ago, 10% of the population didn't have to borrow. That 90% were net borrowers and the rest were net savers.
Uh-huh.
So in order to get the money of the net savers, you're going to have to do something besides lock them into debt. So for that, we have negative interest, which is basically a tax on their deposits.
Right.
They push to go cashless so they don't have somewhere else that they can put their money. And the push to expose all their money that may be hidden in offshore tax havens or anywhere else, all this stuff where you can conceal your money in corporations where, your name's not on it. So they want to expose all that stuff so they can get the money.
And if you make the point that this is likely to also precipitate a clamping down on having hard assets and commodities, precious metals, gold, and so forth.
All the gold bug sites are saying that this is an argument for getting your money into gold. That's what we've got to do. But the concern is that they will ban holding gold, like in 1933 when Roosevelt said that you couldn't hold gold. I mean, they bought out the gold, basically, but they bought it for less than what it was worth. They immediately raised the price of gold after they had bought everyone's gold. So they could do that with our cash, say, your cash isn't any good. Or it's like the Germans in the 1920s where they came out with a new mark, traded it in for the old mark, so they could come out with some sort of new dollar and say, your old dollars aren't any good, bring them in and we'll give you credit in your account.
Yeah, very interesting. We're being led around by these monetary controllers that they lead us into the system of depending upon money and then begin to extract it through interest, and the systems that we rely on to protect it, they undermine with these various stratagems, turning them into digits and so forth. how much more to this runway is there?
Well, it depends on how conspiratorial you want to get, but there is a school of thought out there that the whole goal is to totally lock us into debt so that we're debt slaves from cradle to grave. I saw where they were talking about raising the retirement age in Europe to 75.
No
kidding. Can you believe that? 75? I mean, that means you paid into Social Security all your life, and the average life expectancy is something around 75. So in other words, you're going to work till you die, and then you never get to claim your Social Security, so there's no such thing as retirement.
Wow.
So, and in England, they've already cut down the deposit insurance cutoff. It used to be £85,000, and now it's £75,000. So you can just see them dropping at 50,000, and then eventually they'll say, sorry, we can't guarantee any of the deposits. We don't need all this money to bail out. But there is another way to do it, and that's what I'm going to write about in my next article. They could get out of all of this quite easily, but they first have to nationalize the banks. I mean, you can't let private banks do this, but this is my grand solution that I'm going to present.
You're right. Well,
do you want to know my quick solution?
No. Please.
So we now know that all money is created by banks when they make loans. So all of those loans that are bank-created loans could be written off the books and nobody would be hurt because no money was actually lent. It was money created on the books. The only problem is there's a rule that banks have to balance their books. But if you nationalize those banks, then you could allow them to write off the loans and nobody would be hurt and it would not be inflationary as everybody thinks it would be. First of all, the loan money is already out there. So it's already out there competing for goods and services. The fact that it doesn't have to be paid back is not going to change anything. And the depositors, whose money won't be taken, but they get to keep their money, they don't have any more money than they thought they did. So they're not going to be rushing out and buying stuff they weren't buying before. So you're not going to have a push on prices. Besides which, we need more money out there. That's what they're trying to raise inflation. They're trying to get more money competing for goods and services. So if you allow the depositors to keep their money as they're entitled to it, and you just write off the loans, then you're actually going to help the economy all around.
That's a very elegant and simple solution, and I like it.
Cool.
As you say, it seems to be the only way to obviate the system that has led us down to this systemic bankruptcy. And it's going to have to be adopted, or we'll all just have to give up and follow the orders of our owners.
Give up our retirement. Yep.
Give up our retirement, give up our prospects. Yep. Interesting. Well, Ellen, thank you once again for that insight. And this is a very interesting article. Look forward to your next one, too, now that you've tipped us off to what the content's going to be.
Okay.
Stay safe, Ellen.
Okay, thanks.
And now we're going to introduce you to a new element on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look at what Wall Street costs America.
So, Matt, we've been working on a project at Public Banking Institute called What Wall Street Costs America, opening a national conversation about what the actual impact of Wall Street extraction of dollars and impact of their policies and the loss of that wealth means to cities, counties, and states around the country. Tell us some of the things that you're seeing that are unfolding as you research the impacts of America's losing its financial ground to Wall Street.
I think as I've researched the project, which, as you know, is inclusive of Wall Street fees, high interest rates, and risky financial schemes, all done with public money, with public funds, I think the most disturbing part of the project for me is learning how big financial firms are really fleecing people in need. That the bottom line is that this is money that's being taken out of the hands of people who need it. So you have the situation of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, when the city is forced to beg J.P. Morgan Chase for a $150 million loan at very high interest, just to keep things like safe water supplies and other types of public safety going. And you have the situation with Charlotte, North Carolina, and Kansas City, Missouri, both of whom had to pay hundreds of millions of dollars just in termination fees. And as a result, both of those cities were forced to cut police and fire budget. And of course, you have the situation with Chicago public schools closing because of a $263 million derivative time bomb that was essentially gambling with school money, gambling with the lunch money, if you will. And of course, you have Detroit and the entire story of Detroit and how that's tied into these predatory Wall Street deals. So in many ways, for me, the foundation, the real motivating factor in this project is not just the numbers and economics and bad budget decisions. It's the system itself seems to produce these agents and actors and institutions who are exercising this destructive influence on everyday life and who are making out with incredible amounts of money while others make out with nothing. That sort of lack of empathy and solidarity on the part of these incredibly powerful financial institutions, I think, is really the biggest philosophical story to be told here when we talk about what Wall Street has cost America.
And it's a way of talking about realizing that our money is more than the commodity. It is really the relationships that we create together as community and our sense of the dependency that we have on our interaction as human beings. So what Wall Street costs America has this depth, really the sinews of our society. There's an open invitation for everyone to participate in what Wall Street costs America by telling the story in their own words and in their own ways, whether it's words or videos or writing or photographs, mm-hmm. but they can tell their story about where they live and what the impacts have been. And then all of that's going to wind up on a website. And here we'll have this new mercado, this marketplace of a citizen interaction and exposition around what their experience has been. How do people participate in this, Matt?
There are many ways to participate. I think the most basic way that almost anyone can do if they want to be involved and do something that almost everyone knows how to do is to send us information, to send us the data that relates to their own cities and counties and states in terms of how much interest is being paid, what the fees are, and also the budget cut that have happened configurally as a result of or against the backdrop of these Wall Street fees. So just, you know, simply writing down and sending cited materials is one thing. Beyond that, though, we would love, as you said, to hear people's stories told by the people who are there, which means, again, writing, but it also means doing things like recording sound files or recording and making videos, which we are already in dialogue with a number of groups around the country, helping them do that and encouraging them to do that, you know, any kind of multimedia effort. And you can get creative, you know, if you want, send us some graphic art, send us some graphics, some graphic memes, send us, write a song about what Wall Street has done to damage your city. You know, we would love to facilitate this national dialogue to be a truly grassroots dialogue. And so people who have questions about how they can send that stuff in and how they can be part of this project and how they can be credited on the webpage as being part of this project can certainly communicate with me at matt@publicbankinginstitute.org. And we have ready-made information to send out to you if you are interested in being part of the project. So you won't be going into this blind. You will be going into this with tools that we can provide you to tell that story, to tell your city's, your state's story in a variety of different and compelling ways.
And we're early enough into it so that there are opportunities here for you to express yourself in a very expansive way in participating with this. But it isn't just about talking about the Wall Street impact, but it's also about setting a stage for change and for action. It's one thing to talk and to complain, or to at least to describe and to share, but it's another thing to get down to an effective strategy around action. And that's what Wall Street Costs America campaign is about. A chance for citizens to get out of their particular personal interests, perhaps, and stand with their fellow citizens with the knowledge and the data that emerges from the research and resources that we provide, to go then to their city council, to the governors, their mayors, and say, look, there's an alternative to Wall Street. We don't need to rely on this extractive vampire squid, as Matt Taibbi calls it. There's an alternative. We can have our own bank. We can keep our money at home, invest in ourselves, and create a vibrant, vital, and sustainable economy built around our interaction and in our relationship with each other.
So, yeah, I think that's a very important part of the entire piece that we haven't mentioned yet today, which is that we know there are alternatives. There are sustainable alternatives that can localize and be responsible with our public finance. And so certainly making people aware of the extent of the problem and how it has affected all of us personally is a very important step. And then, of course, you know, the other half of that equation is the classic what is to be done kind of question. That obviously is where the Public Banking Institute comes in.
Well, thanks, Matt. We're all very excited about the project, and the website isn't up just yet, but you can find out more about the project by coming to publicbankinginstitute.org, and you'll find a link to the What Wall Street Costs America campaign and project there. And in the coming weeks here on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, Matt will be back to describe in a little bit more detail and with some interviews with people in these markets what Wall Street has cost America. And we'll be able to examine that in a little bit more depth. You'll probably recognize some of the symptoms and some of the afflictions yourself, but this is the start of an exciting new day for citizens to discover and then act on what Wall Street is costing America.
My guest today is Les Leopold, co-founder and director of the Labor Institute in New York City and the author of many books. His latest book was published last October and is called Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice. It's great to be talking to you again, Les.
Ellen, it's a great pleasure to be here.
You've written some really interesting articles lately on the revolution that seems to be going on among voters, especially young voters. I have to first say that Public Banking Institute is a 501c3 nonprofit corporation, and we're not supposed to endorse particular candidates. So if I should say anything that sounds like an endorsement, I'm just talking for myself and not on behalf of PPI. But what particularly interests me about what's going on in these elections is we do seem to have a revolution going on, and for me the interesting thing is how they're going to fund their proposals, particularly, you know, the ones that benefit we the people. I think they have more money to play with than they're aware of, that they could do what the American colonists did and authorize the federal government to issue money directly, or Congress could authorize the Fed to do quantitative easing for, like, infrastructure and social programs. Anyway, so it's all very interesting what's happening in the political realm here. I think they need an economic revolution to support their political revolution. So one of your recent articles that it particularly caught my attention is called "Is Hillary Clinton Running Away from Political Reality?" And you got 1,600 comments on that on Alternet. So obviously a lot of people thought it was interesting. Do you want to go into what you were writing about and what got people?
Well, I think the basic point there was to note that Hillary Clinton really doesn't understand runaway inequality. She just doesn't get it. What I was seizing upon was her comment where she thought she was a poor person in 1973 when she was making $14,000 a year. And in fact, that's the equivalent of $75,000 a year now. And she just has been lost touch, if she ever was in touch. I mean, you know, she was a person who went to Wellesley and Yale Law School, and she was surrounded by very smart people, but also very wealthy people, and they've become her peer group, her reference group, and kind of the rest of us who may be struggling to get by are in a different world. And she doesn't understand the makings of that other world. She doesn't understand that we have to have a halt to runaway inequality, which means a transfer of income and wealth from Wall Street, basically, to the rest of the country, from CEOs to the rest of the country. And this has to happen in a multitude of ways, and unfortunately, she's not capable of embracing them. So, for example, the proposal to have a financial transaction tax to fund free higher education and financial speculation tax, free higher education and infrastructure rebuilding, is a very, very important proposal. You know, as my book pointed out, 40% of all corporate profits by 2007 were going to Wall Street, which only had 5% of employment in the country. So 40% of the profits are going to 5% of the workers in the country. That's tremendously imbalanced. And it's hard to tax the money back once it gets into the hands of rich individuals. They so quickly move it abroad and into tax shelters, and they have an army of lawyers to do that. So getting it out of Wall Street into the real economy is very, very important. That combined with your pet proposals, and I think you've had an impact on this election, whether you know it or not. You certainly have an impact on some of the unions that are supporting Sanders, because they're raising the cry of public banking. So the second, it's sort of like a pincer move. One is to move money through the financial speculation tax. The other is to actually begin to challenge Wall Street's domination of everything, strip mining the economy, by having public banks. And those public banks can do a lot of things that you described. I think people are not aware of the degree to which financial strip mining is going on. And that's something that we've really been pushing it both in the book and in our educational programs. By the way, I just came back from Austin, Texas, where we trained 30 people to be economics trainers. And you'll be happy to know that they're very fond of public banking as a result of the 3 days that we had with them.
Oh, but, good.
So, for example, in New Jersey, the pension fund pays $600 million a year in fees to Wall Street banks or hedge funds, basically, to do alternative investments, which aren't paying off. And we've got a situation in Los Angeles where, because there's no public bank, they turn to Wall Street for financing, and the fees a year ago, the fees paid by Los Angeles to Wall Street banks was $300 million in 1 year. And that's greater than what they spend on their roads. And now we're not even talking about interest payments or principal. These are just the fees to set up these elaborate deals. And I don't believe that happens in North Dakota, where, of course, there are not as many needs, but there are still infrastructure needs. And I think the Bank of North Dakota probably helps out there. So public banking is key to this process. So Hillary's against that. She's against the financial transaction tax. She's against free higher education. And I think it's because really, she's surrounded by people who would lose in that proposition. And her alternative model is basically pragmatism, that I can get things done and we need to move slowly, but it's not clear what direction we're moving in. Her big campaign line is remove all barriers. Well, what does that just mean? I mean, that rich and poor alike can be at the starting line and compete with each other to get the riches of this country. Well, that's not going to happen when you have runaway inequality. If you're a low-income person, you're never going to be at the same starting line if you're Hillary Clinton's daughter, for example. Mm-hmm.
Especially if you don't have higher education paid for.
Right. Yeah. So, actually, it's kind of sad, because when I started working on the piece that you read, I started to wonder, well, did Hillary Clinton have any student loans at all? Because in that piece, she was talking about how she could afford to take a low-paying job, $14,000/$75,000 a year, because she had a student loan forgiveness program, which limited her loan repayments from law school to the percentage of her income. So she was very proud of that, and she boasts about that in several speeches. So I started to look that up, and it turns out that program didn't start till 1989 at Yale Law School. So I think she's making it up, and that's just sad, because I'm not happy to have what could be a presidential candidate and a president feeling compelled to make things up. But I think it all comes from her not really understanding runaway inequality, kind of not wanting to understand how big the gap is between the super rich and the rest of us and how that's built into the economy. They're, you know, breaking all barriers is not going to change it. You know, you need heavy-duty proposals like public banks, financial transaction tax. You need free higher education. You need really big proposals to break the back of runaway inequality. So that's what we're trying to do. By the way, our first edition of the book is almost sold out. We're working on a second edition. And what I'm including in the end is, you mentioned funding at the very beginning. I want to talk about another kind of funding, which is, how are we going to fund this political revolution? What's going to happen after November? Nobody, even if Bernie Sanders wins in a landslide, he can't do this on his own. It requires the building of a mass movement. It requires many, many of us coming together in a new way. So what is that new way, and how is it funded? Well, the funding, I think, could come from the 5 million or so donors who are giving an average of $26 to the Sanders campaign. What are they going to do next? Clearly, they support this agenda, this new agenda. So how do we keep them involved? So I see four elements of this of a new movement. And we're going to put this in the back of the book as well. One is a common agenda and a common analysis. And I think, actually, you've been very close to that for many years now. You've added key pieces of that agenda, and I think it's going to be adopted. I think public banking is going to be in there. So we need a kind of populist, a progressive populist agenda with 5 or 10 points, no more, and a common analysis that ties them together. So that's one thing we need, and I think we're very close to building that, and Bernie is field testing it for us right now with his, attacking the billionaire class, the corrupt political finance system, and so on. The second thing we need is we're going to need a new national umbrella organization like the populace had in the 1880s, something that ties all of us together so that you and the Public Banking Institute could be part of it, and my little labor institute could be part of it, and unions could be part of it. And we could go wherever we went in the country, we could go to a meeting of our new organization and talk about how to stop financial strip mining on a state, local, and national level. So there'd be some coherence.
I love that idea.
Well, think about it. We had 900 encampments around the world, but I must have had several hundred Occupy Wall Street encampments. Imagine if that was an organization instead of just a sort of a spontaneous rebellion that kind of faded in 6 months. We could have a real infrastructure. So that, I think that's the second piece we need. The third piece we need, and this is a piece I'm working on deliberately, is a educational infrastructure where we train people to go out and explain the platform and provide workshops on the analysis behind it. The populace in the 1880s had 6,000 educators going around the country, so we need about 30,000. And a couple of I'm actually having very good luck. I've done two train-the-trainers with the Communication Workers of America. We're doing another one coming up with Citizen Action. We're talking to groups in New Jersey about doing one there, talking to groups in the state of Washington. This is a very popular idea. So if we could get this going, I don't think it would be that difficult to get it going on a mass scale. I mean, right now, you know, we have 50 or 100 trainers, but I think we could get it to a much larger number very quickly. And there are all kinds of talented people who listen to your radio show, for example, who would want to get involved. We haven't figured out how to open it up to the public at large yet, but we'll get there, I'm sure, after November. Mm-hmm. The fourth element, though, and this is the hardest one, this is our heads, believing that we should become movement builders and changing our identities from just being inside our silos. Let me explain, because this is not an easy concept. Right now, the progressive movement is balkanized, fractured, in a series of silos. I'm a labor activist, or I'm a Black Lives Matter activist, or I'm an environmental anti-fracking activist, or I'm a public bank activist, and so on. And, the big ones, environment, identity, and labor, are three big ones right there. And people are very comfortable. Not only are they comfortable with their identities, but it nourishes them. There's a pride in it. But one of the reasons runaway inequality has gotten away from us is because we've been fractured for the last generation, and we have not had a coherent movement response. And that coherent movement response requires that in our minds we're going to make our silos porous. We're going to become silo busters. We're going to become movement makers, and that broader movement becomes an identity where an injury to one is an injury to all. We see that the tragedy that befell the various young men who were had been killed on the streets for no reason whatsoever, just by police. That's an injury to all of us. That's not what justice is about. Also, you know, the fight for 15 is a fact that people get paid starvation wages is an injury to all of us. So we have to have an agenda that shows how these things are connected so that we can have this broader identity. But let me tell you, getting that kind of consciousness is really, really hard, because after a generation of viewing ourselves inside a silo, a particular silo, it's hard to get out. I'm not saying we abandon our silos, that labor stops being labor entirely and Black Lives Matter gives up on that stuff. No, I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying to reach out beyond that and realize we have to be movement builders, movement makers. And that's really hard. When we start off doing these training sessions with folks, it's amazing how deeply their day-to-day work limits their ability to think of a bigger picture. That's what makes Bernie so interesting. Whether you like him or not, the fact is that he has opened the imagination of a new generation of people. He's getting 60, 70, 80% of young voters, including people of color. This is remarkable. I don't remember a candidate doing this since Bobby Kennedy, and I'm not sure he had that kind of support. And the different, you know, Kennedy was a charismatic guy. I mean, you know, Bernie's like a schlump. You know, he's sort of anti-charismatic. but his proposals are what's shaking people up and helping them get out of their silos. Mm-hmm. So I'm having this conversation. I'm involved in this conversation with groups all over the country. And that last step is going to be the make or break one for us. The mm-hmm. very nice thing about all this is our book is being used as a text because it's designed to show the linkages between all these different silos. It shows how runaway inequality, the financial strip mining by Wall Street and CEOs of corporations, communities, students, et cetera, how that links many, 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 many issues. Let me give you one example. I know I'm blabbing on here, but I want to show linkage that is normally not seen. I'll give you two examples, actually. Here's one. Environment. Everyone's familiar with the bailout of the auto industry. One of the people working on that bailout was a guy named Wilson, and everyone hoped that the bailout would lead to a new General Motors that would be building green cars, greener cars for sure, and maybe could lead the world in that technology. After all, you know, the taxpayers' money was going to rescue General Motors. So this guy Wilson was one of the people on the committee for the Obama administration, did a good job on the bailout, leaves the Obama administration, goes to a hedge fund. The hedge fund then takes a 32 million share position in General Motors. Then it demands that General Motors do a $9 billion stock buyback to take the surplus it's developed. Instead of putting it into R&D, which is where all of us hoped that they would do, they would take the money and give it back to the hedge fund that did absolutely no work whatsoever, except this guy being trained on public money to do the bailout. So he knows the intricacies of the bailout. Now he goes to a hedge fund. So what happened? On January 13th, GM announced another $5 billion stock buyback, bringing the total to, I believe, $9 billion. So that money's leaving GM and ending up going into the pockets of the hedge fund magnates. And, you know, that process of that's financial strip mining. A stock buyback, imagine you and I own a company, and there's two shares. It's a $1 million company. Your share is worth $500,000, and my share is worth $500,000. I buy you out. Now there's one share left. That share is now worth $1 million, all things being equal. The company didn't change. So if you take General Motors, it has a certain amount of earnings per share, which determines the value of the stock. Well, if you reduce the number of shares, every share that's left has a higher earning per share, and therefore, marginally, the share price goes up. So if you buy back a large number of shares, like for $9 billion, the share price is going to go up the next day. As soon as you announce that, the share price goes up. Well, then the hedge fund cashes in. The share price, if they have 32 million shares and the share price goes up in the next 10 days by $2 a share or something like that, they're going to make $65 million in a matter of weeks. So stock buybacks. By the way, in 1980, before deregulation of finance, there were no such things virtually as stock buybacks in terms of CEOs being paid that way or people using them very much. Mm-hmm. Now, by 2007, 75% of all corporate profits went to stock buybacks. That's financial strip mining. And we described
instead of going into development.
Development, yeah. Salaries. I mean, this is why the whole idea of serving multiple stakeholders became foreign, because there was a rule change in 1982 in the SEC, Securities Exchange Commission, by the Reagan administration. He appointed a guy who headed E.F. Hutton, a financial firm, to be head of the Securities Exchange Commission. And he said, oh, stock buybacks, which used to be considered stock manipulation. He said, oh, it's no problem. We're not going to prosecute that. And basically, they made it legal. Before that, it was called stock manipulation. It was one of the reforms put in the 1930s to stop companies from manipulating their own shares. Now it's done, if you read the paper, it's done all the time, every day. Anyway, so this is a travesty, not just for the company, and not just because somebody's going to get filthy rich, but how did they get rich? They got rich at the expense of the environment. So we have to see the connection. Another example, Ferguson, Missouri. We see this as blatant racism and police brutality, and in many cases, that's much is to be said for that analysis, but it's not the entire analysis. Ferguson, Missouri, always, up until the financial crash of 2007, secured 7% of its local revenues from fines and forfeitures. In other words, getting people into the criminal justice system, parking tickets, speeding tickets, various misdemeanors that where they owe the court. They owe to pay for the fine. If they don't show up, then they have to pay the court, and so on. They counted on 7%. There's a graph for this that we have in the book that's just steady all the way till 2007. Well, the crash hits, and now the local revenues are in trouble. And this is true also for another 21 counties around St. Louis. They got into trouble financially because there was, the bottom fell out due to the Wall Street crash, and businesses went down, and incomes went down. People were laid off, and so they had less money. You know what they did? They doubled. They went from 7 to 14%. They told the police, we got to double the revenues. They told the courts, we got to double the revenues we get from our low-income citizens. We got to go out there and basically harass them, bring them into the criminal justice system. And Michael Brown, guy walking down the street, gets harassed just like that, ends up dead. He wouldn't have ended up dead, I don't believe, if they hadn't decided to solve their financial strip.
Yeah,
they increased the quota, basically, to solve a financial problem caused by Wall Street. So the financial strip mining goes everywhere. I don't have to tell you this. You've seen it. You wouldn't be advocating public banking if Wall Street was doing something other than ripping off state and local government right and left and countries, as you
know. And it seems to me we could solve the whole problem by making banking a public utility, making the money. Right now, all of our money is created by banks when they make loans. It should be created by the government and issued to pay for goods and services that, you know, for real things. In other words, not for speculation, not for driving up the prices of existing assets, but to develop.
Well, you deserve some sort of an award because your message is getting out. The Postal Workers Union has adopted it. And now the communication workers have put it on its anti-financialization agenda, using the post office as a public bank. So I think that time has come. I think this is something that we have to advocate very heavily during this election and afterwards.
I love your idea of organizing. I mean, that's definitely what people write to me all the time, and they say, what can I do? And, you know, we make our little suggestions. But if, like you said, if there was a big populist movement of some sort, like you'd have an entity in every town that you could drop into when you were there, volunteer for.
Absolutely. And, you know, in the short run, this is not satisfactory, but it can be done. The book's set up with questions at the end of every chapter, so people can actually use it like as a study group. Workers are handing this out to other people. They're making copies of certain pages, or they're getting other copies of books. By the way, none of the money from this book is going to me personally. It's all going back into the education campaign that my institute's part of, because it just didn't feel right doing a book around runaway inequality and then, you know, making a lot of money on it if the book's successful. Maybe next time, but this time I'm going to – these editions, we're definitely going to throw the money back into the campaign. So people are using the book that way, and, you know, we're getting a lot of positive feedback from everyday working people who can read this book. You know, it's not – somebody asked me, well, you know, aren't other people like Stieglitz and others writing books about this and Piketty and all? I said, yeah, but they're writing it at a different – level of comprehension. They assume that you have a very strong familiarity with economics and you read at a high level. So I'm aiming at everyday people who have no background in this and have to be introduced.
And you're aiming at what they can actually do about it, not just
absolutely
theoretical. Yeah.
And, you know, at the end of the book, I've got a chapter that aims at talking to young people, organizers, young organizers, because it's really on them. You know, I'm getting a little long in the tooth, and I felt it this week because I had to go to Duluth and do a workshop and then fly down to Austin, Texas, and do three more days. So I've been, you know, I was gone for 8 days in a row counting the travel. And I'm thinking, whoa, you know, we got to get some young people doing what I'm doing. And it's really going to be on them. And what's great is they're already rising to the occasion. They're the reason Sanders is even in this race. He'd be long gone if it weren't for the youth vote. So we're trying to get folks at that early level to get outside of their silos right away. You know, don't get trapped thinking that, you know, your entire life's going to be spent working on a particular housing problem. Yeah, you can do that, but that's not enough. You have to involve
them. I mean, there's an actual push to try to separate people and make them afraid of their neighbors, like with all the terrorism that may be false flags, as far as we know. So anything that can bring people together and get us seeing the big global picture and seeing what the cause is and how we can move it forward, I think that's great.
That's key, absolutely key. And, you know, what's been really excellent about your work is it's always had the global big picture. You're asking the most fundamental question, which is, what is banking? And, you know, what is it there for? And it leads to the sister question, which is, what's an economy for? You know, the way we're brought up, we're brought up to believe that our goal in life is to kind of serve the economy as opposed to the economy serving the needs of people, right? We're supposed to make this stuff work for us. My goal in life is not to have a billionaire on Wall Street. That's not what we were put on earth to do. We may be forced to do that because of the way in which the political and economic system got rigged, but we can unrig it. And what's great about what you've been doing is that you found one of the key elements for unrigging the economic system.
Yeah, and you're doing it too. I think it's great, this whole movement toward, I mean, you can see it's not just Bernie. Donald Trump is, you know, a revolutionary in his way, and Jeremy Corbyn in England, and you have things going on in Europe, movements that have gotten crushed, but the movements are there. I mean, the people are ready. The people want to do something
right.
new.
So we have to decide that we're going to do it. That we're going to build an alternative movement.
I think what people are looking for is they want to do it, but they're looking for the big picture. They're looking for how to get connected. So that's where your work is so important.
Well, we're trying. Again, the piece that I'm not really at that national organizational level. There are a lot of people I know who are thinking about organizations after the fall, you know, who's going to get the mailing lists and what's going to happen next. But the educational infrastructure that we can use anywhere, any group, any place in the country, that's what I want to build. I sort of feel like I was put on earth to do that. I've been working on that for like 40 years. And I feel like, you know, we know something about how to communicate these ideas. I mean, it's not going to be perfect. It's going to change. But we're going to do a Spanish edition of the book because a lot of the worker centers and immigrant workers are very interested in this and been talking to me. We'll say, when are we going to have it? So, you know, I think we have a shot at building that educational infrastructure. And I pray the organizers who are up another level can build us that national umbrella so we can all work together. I'd love to be in the same organization as you. I would really like that.
I would too. Cool. I just had one other question on my list here. You had mentioned about offshore tax havens, and that was one thing that Hillary had failed to mention. And, of course, that's been in the news of late with the Panama Papers, and I just wrote about it myself. But I just wonder, what would you, since we're aiming for solutions here, what do we do about that? How do we get that money back?
We've got to shut it down. I mean, the world is electronic, and you know as well as I do that look, if that money was terrorist money, the United States and it was going to the Cayman Islands or Panama, do you think the United States would let that money go there? I mean, we have the means to track it down. We have no will at the moment because, you know, everybody wants – look, once you get part of the – this is where Bernie's really on. When you get part of that big establishment, that national establishment, that international establishment, you have access to money, and you don't want to pay taxes. So there's no real push to stop these offshore havens. And I think it was Dean Baker that pointed out. He says that there's just not the will. We have the means, but not the will. So I think that's got to be part of our revolutionary platform. $21 trillion, $21 trillion is the estimate of how much money is sitting mm-hmm. offshore. It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you personally could figure out a way to stop it.
Well, we have all these interesting challenges, and you're right, we need the young people because we need youth and enthusiasm coming up from the...
I need them to do these 8-day trips.
Right.
In crummy airports and lousy hotels or whatever. I need them to do that. I would have loved to do that 20 years ago, but now I can do a few. But actually what's happening now, and you've experienced this as well, the demand for this is so overwhelming, I can't keep up with it.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting
yep.
invitations to go everywhere. You know, yep. The book supply, you know, like I said, it's almost out. We're rushing to get another printing together. You know, more people are lining up. Can you speak here? Can you go there? And we just need more people to do this. So the sooner we get some more trainers on the road, the better.
Well, that's great. I'm glad you're having such good success with it.
Hey, you're my mentor.
Well, it's been lovely talking to you.
Same here, as
so
always.
Do you have a website? Things
yeah, well, we have on Facebook, we have Runaway Inequality, just on Facebook, and you can join the conversation there. And we put all our stuff as we get it. And then there's a website, runawayinequality.org. If you buy it for a book from us, a little more if it goes back in the campaign. But you can get it at Amazon and Barnes & Noble, Apple, and you can order the book at any of your bookstores. That's Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice.
Okay, great. I've been speaking with Les Leopold, co-founder and director of the Labor Institute in New York City and the author of many books, the latest of which is Runaway Inequality, as he just said, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice.
I'm Matt Stannard with your Public Banking Report. I don't much like presidential elections, and I like presidential primaries even less, because all of my friends are fighting. This candidate is too radical. That candidate isn't radical enough. This candidate can't win in the general. That candidate will win in the general, but only at the cost of their soul, and all of ours to boot. It's pretty maddening. But just to spend a few minutes on the Democratic side of the contest, it's important to be aware that there are some interesting banking reform proposals on the table. Since at least the conventional polling seems to indicate that the winner of the Democratic contest will also likely prevail in November, we can safely assume that some of these things are going to happen concerning banking regulation. I'll give this away, since you're obviously shaking in your shoes. It's probably not going to be radical reform, and it's certainly not going to be the kind of change the public banking movement would like to see. But there's some interesting stuff going on, so geek out on it with me for just a few minutes. And keep in mind, the Public Banking Institute does not endorse nor discourage the endorsement of any particular candidates for public office. Hillary Clinton is rightly perceived to be a few degrees less radical than her opponent Bernie Sanders in her approach to banks. She would not restore Glass-Steagall. She would not proactively break up the big banks. So what would she do? Well, it's certainly not accurate to say that Clinton doesn't want to do anything to regulate the big banks or financial industry. She just doesn't want to do very much. Clinton wants to tax some high-frequency traders, but she's not in favor of an all-out financial transaction tax. She would also enhance the Volcker Rule, disallowing banks to invest up to 3% of their capital in hedge funds. Clinton believes this encourages risky behavior, and she's right, although it's not the only thing that encourages risky behavior. But one particular aspect of her banking proposals deserves a closer look, because even Clinton's most vehement critics admit it's not a bad idea, at least within the current Wall Street should still be in control of America's finance paradigm. Clinton would charge a yearly risk fee on sliding scales on the liabilities of banks with more than $50 billion in assets, along with other institutions overseen by financial regulators. The fee would be higher for firms with greater amounts of debt and those that engage in riskier trading. It would not apply to insured deposits and would have no impact on traditional banking activities. Clinton also promises to force too-big-to-fail banks to restructure themselves if they can't be managed effectively. But she's unclear on how she would do this apart from the way Dodd-Frank already does it. As one analyst pointed out, she doesn't really explain how she'll get regulators to use powers they already have and aren't using now. Dodd-Frank, of course, does a number of other less desirable things, as critics like Ellen Brown have long pointed out. Ellen writes, Dodd-Frank's orderly liquidation authority has replaced bailouts with bail-ins, meaning that in the event of insolvency, big banks are to recapitalize themselves with the savings of their creditors and, in some cases, their depositors. And the rapid demise of community banking is blamed largely on Dodd-Frank's massively complex rules and onerous capitalization requirements. Just doing the paperwork requires an army of compliance officers, and increased capital and loan requirements are eliminating the smaller banks' profit margins. They have little recourse but to sell to the larger banks, which have large staffs capable of dealing with the regulations and which skirt the capital requirements by parking assets in off-balance sheet vehicles. Clinton wouldn't change this. To be fair, neither would Bernie Sanders. Speaking of Sanders, there's this silly talk going around that because he gave an awkward interview recently with the Daily News, he doesn't understand banking reform. In fact, he asserted in that interview that he could use executive authority to break up the big banks. And that's absolutely true. The president can have the Financial Stability Oversight Council declare the largest banks to be too risky, or have the Federal Reserve and FDIC declare the living wills of banks not credible. In fact, our Fairweather friend Dodd-Frank allows for both of those scenarios. The problem is one of political feasibility. Any process that involves agency-level decision-making is going to take time because regulators will have to be replaced. Sanders promised, I think off the cuff, that he could do that in a year. That seems problematic. Sanders also supports reinstating Glass-Steagall, which Clinton opposes. Of course, there's no indication of how he'll get such a reinstatement through an intransigent Congress. Sanders' most sweeping proposals involve reforming the Federal Reserve, prohibiting commercial banks from gambling with depositors' money, directing more money into small businesses, and banning banking industry executives from serving on the board. Those are big things indeed. Combine that kind of attitude with Sanders' support for postal banking and his stated admiration for the Bank of North Dakota, the nation's only public bank, which he made clear in an interview with Rob Call in 2013, but to be fair, hasn't said anything since, it does appear that Bernie Sanders is a little more in tune with some of the more sweeping ideas of the public banking movement than his opponent. Those ideas, however, are likely to encounter steep and vicious resistance at the national level. And Sanders currently lacks an explicit public banking platform that is, in my view, essential to establish the kind of institutional and material base for his proposals to really have teeth, to really be effective, to really build a world where big finance doesn't hijack the democratic process. And since the Democratic Party establishment seems determined to keep Sanders from winning the nomination, these ideas may not get a fair hearing in the general election anyway. But talking about reforms is important, particularly to those of us on the ground in more than 30 states trying to build local economic democracy through public banks, an idea that we already know works well. I'm Matt Stannard. I'm not running for any office. And remember, it's our money.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.